Hello and welcome to New Things Under the Sun. I'm Matt Clancy. This week's episode, what does peer review know? So people rag on peer review a lot, including occasionally New Things Under the Sun. There's a link to one of my posts that kind of looks at it there in the newsletter. Even so, peer review remains one of the most common ways to allocate scientific resources, whether those are R&D dollars or just slots in a journal. So you could ask, is this all a mistake? Or does peer review help in its purported goal to identify the science most likely to have an impact and therefore perhaps more deserving of limited scientific resources? Now, a simple way to check is to compare peer review scores to just other metrics of subsequent, later scientific impact. Does peer review predict eventual impact? And a number of studies find, yeah, it does, at least using quantitative measures of impact. And we'll talk a little bit about some caveats with those at the end. Let's start with peer review at the stage of reviewing research proposals. Lee and Aga, 2015, looks at more than 100,000 research projects funded by the NIH over 1980 to 2008, comparing the percentile rank of the application peer review scores to the outcomes of these research projects down the road. For every grant, they look for publications and patents that acknowledge that grant's support. And besides counting the number of publications and patents that each grant results in, they can also see how often those publications get cited. And note, we're only looking at projects that actually got funded by the NIH, so we don't need to worry that these results are just picking up differences between funded and unfunded projects. And the upshot is, better peer review scores are correlated with more impact, whether you want to measure that as the number of resulting journal articles, patents, or citations. In the newsletter, there's a scatter plot of just the raw data, and it compares peer review percentile rank to citations and publications, and you see basically a lot of noise, but a pretty clear downward trend. Among funded proposals, if people think your proposal is stronger, you're more likely to get publications and citations. Lee and Aga also look at the correlation between peer review scores and impact measures after controlling for other potentially relevant factors, like the year that the grant was made, the field, the PI's publication history, the institution they work at, other career characteristics, and so on. That moderates the results a bit, but basically they still stand. If you compare two grants in the same year in the same study section from a PI who looks, you know, from two different PIs who look pretty similar on paper, well, the grant with higher peer review scores is going to produce more papers, patents, receive more citations, and produce more very highly cited papers. Among funded proposals, the predictive power of peer review seems to be highest at the top. The difference in citations, for example, between the top scoring proposal and one that's at the 20th percentile, that tends to be a lot larger than the gap between citations for proposals at the 20th percentile and the 40th percentile. Moreover, even at the top, the correlation between peer review scores and outcomes is not that strong. If you compare proposals that score at the top to proposals at the 10th percentile, and remember, this is of grants that were still ultimately funded, that top proposal, so the best one they got this year, is twice as likely to result in a 1 in 1,000 top-cited paper. But, you know, I don't know if that's actually that high, since a 10th percentile proposal isn't actually that far off from just average. That means that if peer review is really accurate, you might have expected the top proposal, the best one, to be like 10 times as likely to produce a hit paper than just sort of an average proposal. And it's more like twice as likely. Park, Lee, and Kim, 2015, exploits a peculiar moment in NIH history to provide further evidence that the NIH's peer review processes, on average, tend to pick projects with higher scientific impact than those they reject. In 2009, the U.S. government passed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which was, you know, a stimulus bill meant to fight the economic headwinds of the 2008 financial crisis. The bill authorized $831 billion in new spending, and in that $831 billion, a tiny corner, $1.7 billion, was used by the NIH to fund research projects that would not normally have been funded. So this provides a rare opportunity to see how good projects that would otherwise have been rejected by the NIH, which, as we've said earlier, relies heavily on peer review to select its projects, how do these rejected projects fare when they unexpectedly end up getting funding? When Park, Lee, and Kim, 2015, compare stimulus-funded proposals, those are the ones that got lower review scores, to the normally funded proposals, they find the stimulus-funded proposals tend to lead to fewer publications, and that these publications tended to receive fewer citations. On average, a research proposal with peer review scores high enough to be funded under the NIH's normal budgetary process produced about 13% more publications than a stimulus-funded project. And if we focus on a proposal's most high-impact publication, that is in terms of how many citations it receives, Park and co-authors find proposals funded only because of the stimulus, they tended to get about 7% fewer citations on their most cited publication. Lastly, we can look at the 5% of publications that were funded by these grants that received the highest amount of citations. A normally funded research proposal had about a 7% chance of producing one of these sort of highest impact top 5% papers, and a stimulus-funded proposal only had a 4% chance of proposing one or producing one. So I think these results are pretty consistent with Lee and Aga, at least in a few ways. First, they replicate the general finding that in the NIH, higher peer review scores are associated with more research impact, as measured with these imperfect quantitative methods. But they also find peer review doesn't have like super forecasting acumen. Note that Park, Lee, and Kim are not comparing proposals that just barely clear the NIH's normal funding threshold to proposals that just barely miss it. They don't have the data needed to do something like that. Instead, they're comparing the entire batch of proposals rated above the NIH's normal funding threshold to a batch of proposals that fall entirely below it. And the batch of those normally funded proposals, that's going to include proposals that were rated really highly, like the top percentile. And Lee and Aga's work suggests those ones are where, you know, peer review is the best at identifying hit papers. So even when we're comparing stuff that, you know, was uniformly below the threshold to everything above it, including the absolute best, the differences aren't like enormous, I think. So we have some similar results about the correlation between peer review scores and citations at the publication stage too. I have another post titled "Do Academic Citations Measure the Impact of New Ideas?" And that one discusses in a little bit more detail a paper by Card and Della Vigna, 2020, which has data on about 30,000 submissions to four top economics journals, including data on their peer review scores over roughly 2004 to 2013. Now, in economics, it's actually quite common for draft versions of papers to be posted in advance of publication. So Card and Della Vigna can see what happens to papers that are accepted or rejected from these journals, including how many citations they go on to receive in the future, both as drafts and as published versions somewhere else. Now, as with Lee and Aga 2015, they're going to find that there is indeed a positive correlation between the recommendation of reviewers and the probability that a paper is cited, or in this case, among the top 2% most highly cited in that journal. And this isn't just because if you get a high peer review score, you're going to get published in one of these top economics journals, although that does help. Card and Della Vigna also tracked the fate of rejected articles, and they find that even among rejects to these journals, those that get higher peer review scores, they still go on to receive more citations. Seiler, Lee, and Barrow, 2015, obtained similar results using a smaller sample of submissions to the Annals of Internal Medicine, the British Medical Journal, and the Lancet over 2003 and 2004. They've got a sample of 139 submissions that received at least two peer review scores, and then from this set, they can also track down what eventually happened to that submission. Either it got published in one of these journals or perhaps published somewhere else. Among this group, 89 peer-reviewed submissions were ultimately rejected, and for those 89, the peer review scores that they got were positively correlated with the number of citations that the submissions eventually received, although the correlation was pretty weak. For the 40 submissions that were reviewed and also accepted at one of these top three journals, again, positive peer review reports were correlated with the number of citations the article eventually received. But in this case, the correlation was actually so weak that you can't rule out that it's just statistical noise. Possibly, because the sample is just 40 papers, pretty small. Seiler, Lee, and Barrow also emphasized that the three journals actually rejected the 14 papers that would eventually go on to receive the most citations, though they did manage to grab the 15th most cited paper. Perhaps more reassuring is the fact that, generally speaking, papers that went on to be highly cited did tend to be identified as publishable in other journals pretty quickly. There's a figure you can't see, but it compares the eventual number of citations received to the time elapsed between submission to one of these three journals under study and eventual publication somewhere else. No highly cited papers take longer than 500 days, which is not great, but better than a lot of papers which take, you know, more than 1,000 or 1,500 days to find a home. That could be because peer review at one of the next journals the paper was submitted to was quick to recognize the quality of these articles. Or maybe these articles were rapidly submitted to other journals because they got favorable feedback from their initial peer reviewers. But this evidence is pretty indirect, and other explanations are also possible. Like maybe the authors just believed in the paper's merits, and so they submitted more frequently for review. Or, you know, it could also be that these papers were just desk rejected a lot, and so they were able to resubmit fast until they just finally got lucky with somebody. Tough to say. That said, we also have one more study looking at peer review reports and eventual impact, this time in the American Sociological Review. Teplitsky and Bakanek, 2016, have data on 167 articles published in the American Sociological Review in the 1970s, as well as their peer review scores. But among this set of published articles, they find no statistically significant relationship between the peer review scores and the number of citations papers eventually earn. After analyzing a sample of the peer review reports, they're going to argue this is because for the American Sociological Review, reviewers just don't seem to be that focused on the likely impact of submitted papers. In their analysis of reviews, around 20% of positive comments, which, you know, are not that common, praised the topic choice, and roughly 6% of negative comments also focused on the choice of topics. So you could argue that that could have something to do with, we think this is an important topic and we think it will, you know, be highly cited and so on. The vast majority of comments, though, just focused on sort of general impressions, like this is a nice article or this was interesting. Or they focused on the soundness of the argument or maybe made concrete criticisms. In any event, it doesn't seem to be that preoccupied with how many citations these papers are eventually going to get. And in fact, you know, no one explicitly mentions anything about we should accept or reject this paper based on the number of citations we think it will get. So I think the above citations still find reasonably consistent results. If you've got a lot of data, like thousands of papers or applications, you seem to be able to confidently pick out the peer review signal from the noise. Stronger peer review scores are correlated with subsequent measures of impact, whether that's the number of publications or the number of citations those publications receive. The Lee and Aga 2015 study, which draws on the largest data set of all, also finds peer review is predictive even after you control for a lot of other observable variables, like the prior career track record of the PI, the school they go to, and so forth. These studies also find the signal of peer review, though, isn't like super strong. The best we can do is pick something with, you know, maybe on the order of magnitude of like twice the probability of being a hit relative to the average funded project. Bear in mind, that's not necessarily the average project. There could be others that are rejected that are just really bad. Part of that may simply be down to just the noise in citations. There's another article where I argue that citations are very noisy measures of sort of the value of articles, because that noise could tend to pull estimated correlations towards zero compared to what we would get if we were able to properly measure all the relevant variables. At the same time, plenty of other papers use citations, and they find stronger relationships between whatever they're interested in and the citations received. And I think that suggests that the noise and imprecision of peer review is not purely down to issues with the citation data being inaccurate to sort of sniff it out. Thanks, everybody. And now it's time for the standard end of the episode boilerplate. You've been listening to a podcast from New Things Under the Sun, a living literature review with the mission of communicating what academia knows about innovation in accessible but rigorous research syntheses. New Things Under the Sun is a living literature review, which means I go back and update these research syntheses as new research is published or I discover it. The podcast you listen to is taken from the first published version of one of these syntheses. To see if there's been any updates about the claims made in this podcast, or to learn more about this project, head to newthingsunderthesun.com.